This is Visual Reel 3. So, in these 2 years in Theresienstadt, were you optimistic or pessimistic about what your fate would be personally?
I tried never to be pessimistic, because I am obviously optimistic by nature, and I was getting on with my work and trying to shut my eyes to what was going on around me, which was cowardly, I know that. And I worried terribly about my husband, and my little nephew was very ill and was more dead than alive quite often. He had scarlet fever, he had jaundice, he had typhoid, he had all sorts of terrible illnesses, and was in hospital most of the time, and grew very rapidly, and I worried for him too, but of course I could not help. I visited him every day wherever he was, but there was no chance of helping him. Altogether, because I saw that I could not help anybody, I tried to push it away. And I think it was the only thing one could do at the time. So I spent my days painting with very nice people and got back and then prepared some sort of a supper. And my husband and my nephew and my mother came to me, because I lived in slightly better dormitory than the others at the time. And we had an hour together, a family hour together, and then my mother had to be back, go back, and so did the little boy. My husband, who was so-called social worker, who distributed permits for having your shoes soled, or for having a shower, or for having a little more food. He was in charge at one of those barracks for the social work of the barracks, and was very much beloved by everybody there. And of course, I saw him get thinner and thinner, and tried to take no notice of it. Till he had those terrible pains and was taken to hospital and operated on.
Did you fall sick yourself in Theresienstadt?
I was sick once or twice. Yes, I once had a very nasty sinus trouble and fainted, but on the whole I was fairly healthy. Few colds, nothing special. No, I wasn't really ill. Just when I had this sinus trouble.
Did you ever hear of any escapes?
There were the escapes. One did not really hear of it, but what was much worse, I didn't follow these escapes. What was much worse, that if somebody found a cigarette or smoked a cigarette, the lights were turned off in the dormitory. So you had no light. So you came back from your work into a completely dark dormitory and were supposed to get your supper ready or whatever you had to do at night in the dark. Now you could have candles. To get candles you had to know somebody who had candles. You can't call it a black market, but it was a sort of swindling along, muddling along. I painted little miniatures, and for those little miniatures, somebody else who had a piece of cake or a piece of bread gave me the bread, and then I could go and exchange that bread for a candle. This was the way one had to try and cope with daily life. I personally am slow in everything. I had no time to worry very much, or to go around and see what other people did, or to know very much about lectures and concerts and theater, because I just did not have the time and the strength to do a lot of outside work or entertainment, as one could call it. There were concerts, there were theaters in the barracks. That is where the Emperor of Atlantis was produced. And I myself went to a lovely concert of Haydn's creation and went to lectures. A friend of mine took me to lectures on Greek mythology, but that all was only after my husband's death, because, and in spring, it was easier. Whereas as long as my husband lived, I was there for him in the evening, that 1 hour. I met my husband every day for lunch. We tried to eat our lunch out of our tin bowls together. And otherwise, of course, we were not together.
Why did they switch out the lights in the dormitory?
As a punishment for somebody having a cigarette. You were not allowed to smoke in the camp. But if the Germans noticed that some Jew or Jewess had a cigarette, you either were taken and beaten or some sort of punishment. And if you found one or two smoking, then they switched off the lights. That was a terrible punishment and made life very, very difficult. Because not only did you have to stay in your dormitory in the dark, or with one or two candles for 20 people, but you had to balance your way to the so-called lavatories, and everything was dark. This was made life very difficult, and that was a very terrible punishment.
Did you see any of the beatings?
I never saw a beating. I never saw a beating, and I never saw anybody being arrested. I sort of seemed to have lived in an ivory tower, because if I read books now about Theresienstadt, there's so much horror in those books, which I personally never saw. But I must admit, I had friends in my painting department who made very terrible sketches of the dormitories, of the coffins, of the funerals, of the hospital wards, which were very distressing, and these drawings were found by the German wardens occasionally, and a friend of mine, a very great artist called Unger, he was, for instance, taken away and killed in the other side, in the little fortress of Theresienstadt. And quite a lot of people were just taken away, and then you heard that they lived no longer. Either they were sent to Auschwitz or away, or they were just murdered in the other side of Theresienstadt. I personally never saw anything in Theresienstadt, anything horrible, personally. One just went on with one's life and trying to make the best of it for my family and myself and my friends, and that is all I can say about it. In the dormitories as well.
How did you come to be taken away from Theresienstadt in October 1944?
Well, I was the head of my department said he could not keep me any longer because my type of painting was not essential anymore, and he had to give up two or three people of my department, so I had to go to Auschwitz. And so I got the invitation the next day to leave on the train, and I did not know I was going to Auschwitz. We were just taken away in cattle trucks on a train, and we did not know where we were going. And there is a very great thing in my life happened at the time. One of my colleagues there, a Dutchman, who was he restored the Dutch paintings. The Jews of Holland and very many Jews had beautiful, very valuable Dutch paintings, and they were all taken away from the flats in Amsterdam or in Germany or wherever these people lived, and they all came to Theresienstadt because we had two Dutch masters there, a Mr. Cohen and a Mr. Morpurgo, who were great specialists in restoration of Dutch paintings, and they worked in the room next to mine, and I made friends with them. And Mr. Cohen had adopted a delightful little niece of his, Lisbeth, who was 16 at the time, and she was on the same transport as I was to go off. We did not know where we were going. And Mr. Cohen came to me and said, please take care of Lisbeth, stay with her and take care of our little girl. And I promised, I said, I don't know what I can do for her, but I promise I shall keep an eye on her. And I think this promise saved my life, because coming to Auschwitz, I saw that the younger people and the healthy-looking people were sent off to the left, and although friends who, a doctor and his wife, who were in the same cattle truck as I and Lisbeth, they said, try and look old and ill, you can see there the old people will have less work. And I said, no, I promised Cohen that I would take care of Lisbeth, I'm going with Lisbeth, and pulled myself up and looked strong and healthy, and consequently was taken to the left and not to the right, and the people on the right went straight into gas, which we didn't know, and Lisbeth and I and another young friend of mine went to the left with the healthier looking people, and I believe this saved my life.
Who was doing the sorting?
Mr. Mengele. Mr. Mengele, the doctor, famous Dr. Mengele, and another person in a white coat. They stood when we were kicked out of the trucks. Those people who could walk, walked, and he looked at us, right, left, and this is how we walked then down to the camp, and in the camp, the proceedings in the camp, do you want me to tell you
yes,
that?
Yes, please.
First you were stripped, they took away everything you had, then you were stripped, and then you walked naked towards a sort of turnstile. You had to show your hands, you had a golden wedding ring or any ring that was clipped off with tongues. Sometimes it bled a bit, sometimes it did not. You were stripped of everything you had, you were completely naked. You were driven to another room where they shaved off your hair of your head and your body hair that was all shaven off. I cannot tell you what a horrible impression the shaved heads of women made on their daughters. We looked absolutely ghastly. We got used to it, mind you. But at the moment, one was so thunderstruck that one forgets about the surroundings. We then got old bits and pieces of clothes, but no pants. And the younger people were then offered to have an affair with the Polish or German people who were in charge of that in corners of the hall, and then you got a pair of pants. And if you were not ready to do that, you went off without pants. I got a pair of pants by giving my piece of bread, which I got on the next day, to somebody who had a pair of pants. this is how one then lived in Auschwitz. But as I tell you, thank goodness, only two nights and 2.5 days. That was hell.
When you first arrived, did the inmates who were already in Auschwitz attempt to communicate with you as you queued up?
Yes. We were taken into one of those stable barracks and lined up, and some of those women who were there already came along quite gently and looked at Lisbeth, who was with me, who was 16 but tall, and that woman whispered to her, "You are 21. We didn't know what she said. And then she looked at me and she said, "You are 40. And we didn't know why, thank goodness we remembered that, and that's what we told the woman who then came round to ask our ages, because if she had said she was 16, she would have been taken to the gas. If I had said how old I really was, I would have gone to the gas. But because I looked younger and stronger, I was sent then as a working person to Oderan. We did not know why. I did not even know about gas chambers. Completely innocent, I had no idea. But that is what they conveyed to us, those few women in that stable, that what was going to happen. And when we then were, of course, then there were these, what they called the roll calls, twice a day there or night, whenever they felt like it, one was pushed out of this stable building and stood in front of it, and always 10 and 10 and 10 till all of us were together, and you stood there for hours waiting for the German female guard, or sometimes it was a man in uniform, to count us. Now, during standing there, some people dropped and fainted or died, and they were just left lying around there till we were pushed back again into our barrack, into that building. And what happened to the corpses of the fainted people, I do not know. And then you were called out for food. We got a big bowl of soup and no spoons. And we had no spoons because everything had been taken away. So that bowl went from one mouth to another. Always 10 and 10 women. It was always 10. And you tried to drink that nasty hot soup, whatever it was. And that was, I think, twice a day. And in between, you were taken to the latrines. I'd rather not talk about that. That was absolutely awful. And you were not allowed to relieve yourself as long as you were in your stable building, and so you had to adjust somehow. And you were only taken out to the latrines whenever the commando of that building, they were Polish women, took you. And she again could only take you when the German guard had allowed her or told her to do so. So there was one told the other, you could not, she couldn't do what she wanted. She had to do what she was told, and we had to do what she told us. And then the last moment, just before we left, we were driven out to the building where we didn't know. By then, of course, we had heard of the gas. We did not know whether we were going to be gassed. But we were not gassed, we were just showered with very, very hot water. Very hot water, but all the dirt came off. And then we had nothing to dry us, of course. We put on those rags they had given us, and wet as we were, We were driven out into the cold October wind, and there we stood to dry. And those who did not get pneumonia then went back and were lucky enough to be sent to Ödaran, my people. I don't know what happened to the others. So I can only tell you, then the next morning we got a piece of bread and a piece of sausage and got into, again, one of those cattle truck trains. And the floor of that truck was wet because it had rained at night, so I did not want to sit down. So one stood and we were cramped in it. One stood next to the other. There was only very little room for sitting down. And I stood leaning against the metal doors of this truck, which when it started to move, wobbled to and fro, and I stood on the axle of the wheels, so I had a lovely massage all through my body, and that is when I lost my sciatica.
Permanently?
Permanently. Because it was a sort of osteopathy. They just, it was all right then. I never had this type of sciatica again. And in that truck, I had again a most astonishing experience. There were two boys in charge of us. These boys were 18. They had rifles. They were in charge of a truck full, I think we were 40 women and two or three young girls in it. My Lispus was with me. And we stood in there and we didn't know where we were going. Those boys knew where we were going, but of course one didn't talk in the beginning. And by, I listened to them and I heard their intonation and their accent. And it was the accent of the valley where in Austria, near Salzburg, where I had spent years and years of my childhood summer holidays. So I knew where they were coming from, these two boys. And their name, they called one another Hansel and Walter. And I started talking to them and asked them whether they came from Altersee or Badersee. And from that moment onwards, we were friends, which was a great help for everybody. They immediately said, if we behave without fighting, without yelling, without being hysterical, they would empty the one pail and try to get fresh water in the other pail. And that is all they could do for us. They would open the doors when the weather is fine to have fresh air if we promised to keep quiet. And they really did that. They shared their food with the two young girls we had there. They made us sing, they sang to us. And when we left in Ödaran, we didn't know where we were, but we went through beautiful woods and got into these Saxonian woods and hills. And when we left, one of those boys said, don't be afraid, I know the head of the ward, the German warden in this place. She's quite a good soul, she will not hurt you. Tell her Walter sends his greetings, she will be all right with you. And this is what happened. We came into a building, a fairly modern building, which used to be a factory for weatherproofing textiles. And it was a small, fairly modern building with very bright factory rooms with a lot of glass windows. We had a dormitory in one of those factory places, three bunks, one on top of the other. and with fresh air, there was anteroom with a fountain, drinking water fountain, and a trough around it, so we could wash there. There were quite good loos, nothing to be better even than in Theresienstadt, because it was a modern German building. And there we were, and no work, because they were pulling out the factory equipment and putting in the equipment and machinery for making munition for small guns and anti-aircraft guns and such things. We were to make the munition, but these rooms, halls were not ready yet. They didn't have the machinery. So for 3 weeks we had nothing to do, which was good for not using up strength. On the other hand, it was not good for the morale. So we started to try, some of us, to try and think to keep the younger people from becoming nasty or miserable. And so we started telling one another stories, which was a very good thing. And then work started, and I personally only worked for 1 week because I had pneumonia afterwards. But the work, we had the Saxon, German Saxon foremen who had no idea that we were Jews. They had taken away the Jewish star, and we were criminals, because it was better to mingle for the German workmen with criminals than with Jewish women. That would have been much worse than having to work with a murderer or a robber. So we were murderers and robbers in their eyes, and only by and by they found out who we were. And there you found very good, helpful people amongst these German foremen. And I only, as I say, I was only there 1 week for day or night duty, and then the person who was in charge of us was 18 years old and a very smart young woman. She wanted to give us a treat, and it had started to snow, and the weather was beautiful, so she said, let's go out for a walk in the woods. And we were driven out into the woods with hardly any clothes on, because we had none. And so one caught cold, and I caught pneumonia, and was then put into the sick bay, and which again saved my life. And I stayed in that sick bay to the end, even though I then was much, much better, because I could help the Jewish doctor to take care.